Why you working so hard? The world is ending.
Yay!
It's the apocalypse. Take a day off. It's all meaningless.
And lo, then I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 5 heads. On each of its horns there was a crown, and on each of its heads there was a veiled insult to other esoteric podcasts. Welcome to Talk Gnosis. We're back with our panel. And we are okay. So the Jason Mevel, you know, co-host, you know, for years now, he's been like, I want to do the Book of Revelation. I love the Book of Revelation. I love Jesus and talking about Jesus and the Book of Revelation. Can we do Book of Revelation? So Jason, your time has finally come. So we are doing a panel on the redheaded stepchild, the bastard kid of the Johannine canon, the Book of Revelation. I could also call this one of the other criticisms I get of the show is that you're talking about stuff that doesn't matter. It's not about the current world. It's about some boring stuff from the 1800s. But this is a rip from the headline show.
I also have to say, what's the cross between slander and heresy? Like when you're putting words in my mouth biblically.
Slaracy.
Slaracy, there we go.
Yeah. Hander.
So it is okay to shit talk the other podcast then?
No, it's not.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll cross that off my list. All right.
Okay, although that I was thinking, I put that in because this is like, do you folks all know what a subtweet is? Nick, you're on Philemic Twitter. You know what a subtweet is.
Oh, yeah. It's all over. And Philemic Twitter is so small, you know who everyone's referring to with every yes. tweet, too. But, yeah.
Yeah, so like a subtweet would be like there's a certain Philemic writer from New York who has an Italian mixed Italian Chinese background and he doesn't know shit about anything, right? So I'm not actually addressing who I'm talking about, but everybody knows. And this is sort of like the book of subtweets. That's what got me thinking about it, Clark, because they're arguing with so many people and calling out so many people from fellow Christians to Rome, but we've lost that context. So we, you know, all the people reading the book at the time would have been like, oh, I know who they're talking shit about. Right. I'll leave out the S word. But we don't know now. So this is, for me, the book of subtweets. That's what got me thinking about verbally subtweeting. We love everybody. We love all other podcasts. I only found out. Did you guys actually know there's other esoteric podcasts? I only found out today.
No, I do.
I've never listened to any of them.
So. Oh, good. Anyways, so the Book of Revelation, I'm sure we're going to have some disagreements. We're all going to have different interpretations. We're going to talk about some scholarship, talk about our personal gnosis about the book. But I think we can all agree that this book is about vaccine passports, right?
Yeah, obviously.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Moving on.
Of course, yeah.
I've already got my tattoo to my forehead. I'm going through the healing process. That's why you can't. That's why I won't.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Then
that's
you have to do a chip in your head.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that head was actually a metaphor for mask.
Of course.
Thank you, Jason. Okay, everybody.
Well, we figured it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. Okay. Show's over. That was easy. let's just go around and talk about what we like about this book and what we hate about it. You can also switch that order around. Since it was everybody heard my slaracy. Jason, what did you love about this book and what did you hate about it?
I feel like my job on these Bible episodes is to be like Mr. Hot Take, because I have no real emotional connection to these. That I think this is a really cool book. It's just a shame it's in the Bible. Like it's full of all this like interesting imagery and historical context and the subtweeting, et cetera, et cetera. But then like it's like it just looks like it's this neutron bomb of bad possibilities and ways to continue to leverage it badly for centuries. And so it's like, you know, it's one of those things where like I'm actually kind of imagining whoever actually wrote it back then, like coming to now and getting like a history of all of the people who've ever used the revelations to defend something, including the church itself for all of those centuries, and just being like, oh no, oh no, I'm so sorry, you know, because it's just like it's beautiful, but it also feels like it's a loaded gun when you assume that everything in the Bible is meant to be taken the same way from the first page to the last.
Yeah. Deacon Angie, what did you love about it? What did you hate about it?
I have felt like a good part of my spiritual background has been avoiding the Book of Revelation, so I did appreciate the opportunity to read it. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, what Jason was just describing was really fantastic of like, there's so much going on in imagery. I personally, I don't know if it's just I'm a very pragmatic person and find the imagery a little tedious, or it's definitely a difficult read for me, but hearing somebody that we'll bring up later, Margaret Barger, talk about it was very interesting. But apart from it as a standalone text in the context of the Bible, it's definitely something that I have not particularly enjoyed.
Yeah, it does. There's an awful lot of like angels opening up scrolls and then the seventh angel coming again and smiting and fire, and that just keeps happening over and over again.
And I think the initial part of my spiritual life was in the evangelical community, so it definitely has had I can take part A and not deal with the Book of Revelations and kind of meander my way through this moment. And so looking at it from a different perspective as a Gnostic, you know, does soften that stance a little bit, but it's almost like I've had to protect myself against the Book of Revelations in my previous spiritual experiences. And I'm probably not the only one that has sort of had to navigate that space.
Yeah, 100%. I think it is a very triggering book for a lot of people who grew up in the evangelical community and had bad experiences of that community. Nick Pacetti, what did you love about it? What did you hate about it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I really love the book. It's been really important to me and my own spirituality. So actually, preparing for this podcast compared to the ones we did on John and Mark, I was a little nervous about it because the book is important to me in a way that I guess those other ones aren't as much, but also it's hard to read. And even reading it for this, it's still difficult to read. So there's some element of like, you know, it feels a little bit like something, and I guess people in this world would understand it more, like it's initiatory in some way. It doesn't feel like something that should be like books like, you know, the evangelical, like Revelation for Dummies books or something that's like, this is about America. Like all that kind of, that way of talking about it, to me feels like dangerous, both dangerous and kind of like stepping on this book as a kind of a initiatory experience that should maybe be kept for, you know, people that are ready for it in a certain way and not necessarily something that we kind of throw around. So even that, I was kind of, it gave me a little pause thinking about speaking about it just because, yeah, it does feel like this, it does feel particularly sacred to me, but it also feels worrying to, you know, bring out in the open in that way. So like I'm thinking certain thing I was just looking up, like the Eastern Orthodox community, Revelation isn't like discouraged from people to read it, but also it's like you shouldn't read it outside of a certain context. It's kind of dangerous, and there's been people like Martin Luther even have wanted to throw it out of the Bible. So it's, you know, it's been a controversial book.
Yeah, it's been controversial from the very beginning. There's lots of Christian communities for the first, we're talking 400, 500, 600 years of Christianity that would leave it out. So we have almost complete biblical canons without the Book of Revelation. It's pretty common in early manuscripts. You find lots of proto-Orthodox and other Christian groups being like, this book is garbage. But I do agree, and I think, you know, probably the whole panel does as well, right, about being careful with it. And I kind of like, you know, that Eastern Orthodox approach, right, which is, you know, let's use this sparingly. Let's be very careful of our interpretations. Let's not flash that out into the liturgy and such all the time, or bring in these readings, yada, yada. Clark, what do you love about the book? What do you hate about it?
Well, what I love about it is that if there is ever a sacred text that was asking to be turned into a graphic novel, this was it. Yeah. It's very visual. It's very stark. It's very colorful. And just today I was imagining what it would be like if we could get like Alan Moore and that dude who wrote The Invisibles to do each side. One of them picks like the great beast and the other one picks God. and like, because hey, those two hate guys usually hate each other, right? And just have them go at each other in this, with this book. Anyway, it's a great idea, I think, but that's never going to happen. So
no.
The thing I hate about it is there's a lot of the abuse that comes with this book. So a lot of people have had personal abuse with this in the evangelical context. They use it to beat you over the head spiritually, constantly browbeating you with it. But there's also, this book is also used for a lot of, you know, killing people, quite honestly, to be very blunt. And a lot of folks see this as an excuse to, you know, American evangelicals like to interfere in politics in Israel, between Israel and Palestine, because of this book, because of the stuff that's in this book. And so I think that the problems with this book are even bigger than we've mentioned so far. Like, it's international. It's really weird. It's very strange.
I completely agree with you and the whole panel. For like Nick, this has always been a special book for me, and one that has been very important for my personal spirituality ever since I was young. And I find, even though the symbolism does get a little bit repetitive, again, it's so visual, it's so weird, it's so freaking heavy metal that I just can't look away. But the some of the beauty in it as well, right? Because you do have this redemption of the poor, the redemption of those that are sacrificed, right? There's the ending, the original ending, which we'll get to, which I'll probably read out, that I might even tear up, right? Because I find it so powerful and moving. Lately, I've been having some issues with utopianism. I think it's still good to struggle for a better world. So with this kind of recent... my recent issues with utopianism, of course, this does end with a utopian vision, which I do find still powerful and moving. And obviously how the book has been abused and is currently abused and has been used to oppress people, has been used to start wars, has been used. And of course, within the book itself, right? It is, if you do not agree with the writer of the book, you are going to the lake of fire. And this is other Christians as well. It's a very stark black and white, dualistic book in many respects. But I you know, the symbolism gets me. I find it just, you know, the woman with the stars and the moon and her feet. It's so moving. Okay, so obviously I think we all agree that this is not a book that accurately predicts the future. But I couldn't but help but throw this in. But so the passage, then the third angel blew his trumpet. A large star burning like a torch dropped from the sky and fell on the third of the rivers and on the springs of the water. The name of this star is quote-unquote Wormwood. A third of the water turned bitter, and many people died from drinking the water because it turned bitter. Does anybody know the Ukrainian word for wormwood?
Is it Chernobyl?
It's Chernobyl, yeah. So you can imagine in the 80s, I'm sure some evangelicals were freaking out. I'm sure some evangelicals are freaking out now, right, with everything going on. So I couldn't, sorry, I know that I, especially with what's going on in the world, but I couldn't resist but put it in. But again, everybody, this is not a book that is going to accurately predict the future. Please do not apply it to world events.
When I read that this time, I was thinking about how absinthe is like a wormwood. Yeah. So I thought it made the water into absinthe this time. That's what I pictured. That seemed fun.
That's was a like lot a better. Late 19th
century symbolist painting.
Yeah. That is a very, that's a much more enjoyable end of the world. I vote for that one.
This book is in the Johannine canon, right? And what I mean by that is the opening is said to be by a John of Patmos. The other thing too is it uses specific verbiage that we find in the Gospel of John and the Epistles of John. So people have always seen a connection to the early Johannites. And I am a fan of Raymond Brown's theories about an early Johannine community, about that community having Gnostic leanings and having schisms that become more Gnostic. This used to be a more mainstream scholarly view, although, you know, lately it's been sort of falling out of view, but I think it's accurate. I do see some sort of, you know, some Gnostic-y stuff around the edges, right? Particularly with some of the divine female figures, with the idea of this fallen world, of these suggestions of rulers in the stars. Clark, this is maybe something to think about or speculate. I really love bullshitting with Clark online, you know, I will have a little theory about biblical studies and blow it out into a whole alt history. But I can't see how this book isn't in some way in dialogue with the secret book of John, which is the Gnostic text that opens up with a guy named John having a revelation from Jesus Christ. And then that revelation is not about the future, it's about the past, but it's also patterned on Genesis. And there's a lot of Genesis mm-hmm. talk in this particular book. So that just seems like a little too, you know, one-to-one for me. So I don't know if they're subtweeting each other, if they're completing each other, really what's going on here. But I think there's some kind of connection. But actually, Clark, do you see Gnosis in this book? Do you see whatever Gnosticism is? Do you see Gnostics using this book? What do you think about Gnosticism in the Book of Revelation? Go for it, Clark.
Well, that was kind of my whole thing. So, just reading through, I mean, I've read it multiple times, but it's been several years since I've read it. And, so I kind of agree, like, I only see any actual Gnosticism at the edges. Two or three mentions of the Nicolaitans, who were supposed to be antinomian Gnostic communities. We don't know anything about them, but many readers of this book at the around the time it was put out would have seen the Nicolaitans like that. So between the first seven churches at the beginning, he's giving warnings. He specifically brings up the Nicolaitans, saying they're acting like Nicolaitans, or they're allowing Nicolaitans to be in their midst and all the rest of this. So clearly, very solidly not Gnostic. That throws it out of the Gnostic camp, because it's rejecting any possible Gnostic groups, and it doesn't seem to replace them with anything that resembles any kind of Gnosis in my mind. What I saw was, if you apply a Gnostic worldview to this as a lens to view the whole story through, I don't see a Gnostic story where you would normally see where, like, and this is how the Gnostics are separate from everybody, and this is how they'll be saved. Like, that's not in this book. What's in this book, in my mind, is the archons on one side, and Jesus is specifically called, quote, archon of the kings of the earth. So he's... they're basically saying, from the Gnostic point of view, not from the point of view of the author. From my point of view, there's basically calling Jesus the demiurge, or something demiurgical like. Yeah. And then opposed
up with John stuff.
Say again.
I said that also syncs up with John stuff, right?
Oh yeah, 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 right.
The demiurge and the opening of John, yeah.
Right. No, it does. It does. Yeah. That's very true. And then the archons versus the deceiving spirit of this world.
Yeah.
Which is also a very Gnostic idea. And so the very loose concept I got, which is what led to my graphic novel idea, was that the spiritual archons, from the Gnostic point of view, the planets, the lords, the angels of the planets, which get mentioned later, the seven planets in Jesus, the archon's hand, on one side versus, you know, in this more, I wouldn't say spiritual angle, but I was thinking it more of like a psychological angle. So do you see what I'm saying? Not the pneumatics, but the psychics versus the deceiving spirit in the world, which would have been, you know, the deceiving spirit that was created by the archons to keep human beings tricked and all the rest of this. It shows up under different names in various Gnostic texts. And so these guys are fighting each other. So the enemy, it has a schism in its camp, and it's fighting each other, the more material side versus the more psychological side.
Yeah,
and then I had fun with it. That means that's the only way I could get Gnosis out of this.
Yeah, I think it lends itself well to all sorts of interpretations, right? Because it's so wild, because it doesn't, you know, some of, you know, the Rome stuff, which we'll get into, is very obvious, but a lot of stuff is very obscure, and the symbolism is so powerful. And they may not be specifically Gnostic themes, like, you know, just the idea of Gnosis, of ascent, of revelation, of the divine feminine, you know, those do belong to other streams of mystical religion. But at the same time, they are found in Gnosticism, I think you can add sort of a Gnostic patina to this. I think it's a book that could be interpreted by Gnostics. Also, for the Nicolaitans, I'm pretty sure that this book went through some redactions, right? And that the possibly, just like the Secret Book of John, that the beginning and the end were tacked on later. One of the reasons that I think this is, you can take them off and it reads just fine. But also, the book ends, which I think is the fake ending. If anyone adds anything to this, God will add to his or her punishment the plagues described in the book. If anyone takes away from the prophetic books of the prophetic words of this book, the same. So why does he put that in there? That seems really sus to me, right?
Yeah.
Because when biblical writers do stuff like that, that means that they're doing it a lot of the times, right? So he's saying this because the editor did that himself with an earlier text. So, Jason, do you see any Gnosticism in here? Any gnosis? Any way that you could squeeze some gnosis in, like squeezing juice from an orange?
Well, I'm always of the mind that if gnosis is something that's kind of implicit in the world, then it can be discovered anywhere. Like it can be discovered in the perfectly banal or even the trash of the world kind of thing. Not that I'm saying that this is trash, although I am trash talking Revelations quite a bit. So like vibes that I got reading this were that there may have actually been an attempt to like absorb some of the cool world building that the Gnostics were doing, and just kind of go like, okay, that's neat, but we still need to keep it like kind of within the lines of our orthodoxy. So like, so we have like a cool female figure, but she's kind of also slutty. You know what I mean? Like, so we're, it's kind of this, complementing by stealing, if that makes sense. So that was kind of a vibe I got from it. Yeah, I think that's probably the closest in terms of like something where I would say any sort of explicit Gnosticism. I think it is interesting how much of what's in here comes from books and scrolls and like, and is about this sense of like transmission through narrative. And so I think there's maybe something like, I'm big on Gnosticism narrative as it is. So I think it's interesting that those are dominant symbols in this book that I think, both elevates the book itself that you're reading, but also like reading and books in general as a way to kind of absorb that.
Yeah. You know, I forgot at the beginning of one of the reasons I love this book so much is because of its influence on art, all sorts of art, right? But I think of, I really love Umberto Eco. He's kind of obsessed with this book. It's a big plot line in Name of the Rose. It's a big plot line in The Mysterious Queen, Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana. The symbolism and the wildness of the book has been a great artistic prompt for the last 2,000 years. Deacon Angie, do you see gnosis? Do you see Gnosticism in this book, or do you see any way that we can punch it around to get it out?
I mean, I think it's one of those tricky things where, you know, if you twist yourself hard enough, I'm sure you could get that gnosis experience from it. I can only talk about this in the regards to Margaret Barker, so I'm not sure if you want me to get into that yet, or if you want to pause on that.
You know what? Let's come back to that. I'll ask Nick, and then I'm going to stop going around for the, just, you know, start just throwing out my questions, and then we can all just jump in. You know what I mean?
Just perfect. Wanted to get I didn't want to throw you off the rails, but I'm like, that's the only thing that I can get gnosis from. So I'll.
Okay. Let's come back to that. But Nick.
So I guess if we're talking about gnosis as, you know, what people say Gnosticism is, I feel like this book is pretty anti-Gnostic in a lot of ways. So you do have the ascent, like I think we've talked a little bit about and are going to talk about, in the sense of John gets taken up into heaven and sees these visions, and there's that kind of narrative. So he's receiving this kind of secret knowledge. But then, and this, to be honest, personally, is what I actually like about this book. And I probably am a little bit more of an Orthodox. I'm not particularly Orthodox, but a lot of my ideas come out the other end of Orthodox Christianity. So I would say that this book is like supremely Orthodox almost, because what ends up happening is a descent and not an ascent. So, you know, and it's a universal kind of thing that happens. So in Revelation 21, I'm sure we'll talk about more of the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. It's actually a very material universe that ends up being created through this kind of cosmic process that the book describes. So to me, that's almost the opposite of a like Gnostic, in the sense of, you know, escaping from this kind of material world, if you take that. I know that that's more complicated than Gnosticism, but like this is actually a description of the material universe kind of in an imminent way becoming divine, or sacredness becoming present. And for me, it's like a death of God theology thing, which maybe I can get into later. And so it actually follows the Orthodox kind of logic of incarnation and crucifixion and resurrection very closely. That might be because of my, you know, the influence of Orthodox readings of it on me, but I see it as almost kind of reversing that ascent narrative. So yeah, so in that sense, it's kind of connected, but is the anti-Gnostic almost.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Gnostics said the way up is the way down, right?
Yeah, that's true.
You must first descend.
Well, Nick, it's interesting you brought that up, because one of the things I pulled out of the end when I was reading it is that basically it's just one empire replacing another empire. It's just a big gang fight, right? Okay, so, and, you know, street gang fight or the cops versus the gangs or whatever. And in the end, the big reward is you get another capital city like you already had.
Yeah. It's just
old boss, a new boss, same as the old boss.
It's God's empire replacing the, you know, the Roman Empire or whatever. But right. I do think there is another way to read that, which is not quite as hierarchical at the end, which for me relates to the death of God stuff.
Okay, interesting. All right.
Yeah, let's come to as Nick knows, as people have been picking up from the show, it's not my driving passion, but I've been really diving into atheistic Christianity and death of God stuff a lot lately. And we're recording this during Lent, a great time to talk about death of God theology. But we will come back to that. But Deacon Angie, it is time to nerd out in a different direction. Another one of my passions, a certain theologian named Margaret Barker, who may have come up on the show previously.
Yeah, I mean. It's very interesting to look at it as far as you know, Margaret Barker talks about the great lady quite a bit, and I am definitely going to be having a special place for that concept in my heart. You know, that the Book of Revelation harkens back to so many different historical aspects of the great lady, so the tree of life or the descriptions of the red dragon with the lady, all of that good stuff that I'm sure Deacon John can jump into a little better than I can. But so reading the Book of Revelation and then hearing Margaret Barker talk about it, it made me more inclined to read about that. It's grasping for something that was, that is no longer. That was really interesting. And, you know, as a woman in a fairly patriarchal spiritual tradition, trying to find some kind of femininity and finding it very difficult, but feeling the essence of it everywhere I go, I felt like she really helps lay it out so that you can grasp onto it a little more tangibly. You know, she talks about, and at this point, I'm not sure if I'm going to be talking about the Book of Revelations or talking about her work, so because they blended together in my mind, but, you know, the using the bread as a representation of the great lady and how traditionally women were baking the bread, and how when I'm listening to the podcast, I was also baking bread and just like feeling part of that larger tradition, and that the Book of Revelation is sort of a last hurrah to reach to it. I thought that was very interesting, but that's sort of.
Yeah, she loves this book. She has a 600-page book about this book, which I did not read in preparation because
I didn't read the whole thing. I read the little synopsis. It was like 17 pages. It was delightful.
Yeah, she loves this book. But to give a little bit of context, I believe she does see it as multi-layered. And as I said, I think it went through, you know, at least two redactions. So I think that they are criticizing both the Second Temple and Rome and Christians they don't like. And, you know, you get to have your cake and eat it too. The book is subtweeting lots of people. But very quickly, you know, the Great Lady is this feminine aspect of God that was known in the First Temple, in, you know, the people who would become the Judeans, the people who would become Jews later. I guess we can call them Hebrew, and there was a religious reform that really took out the divine feminine from the First Temple. And when that temple was destroyed and the Second Temple was built, the Great Lady is missing entirely. And there were still groups of people who remembered the Lady at the temple and were very uncomfortable with the Second Temple. So, you know, part of her thesis would be the Lady with the stars of her head with the moon at her feet represents the Great Lady, represents the First Temple, represents the hopes of her being restored. And of course, the Great Lady of the temple becomes Sophia, and she's associated with wisdom. in the Gnostic tradition, and the sex worker of Babylon would be the second temple, right? As well as being Rome, and these things sort of all get tangled up together. But I find it pretty I really groove on her ideas, and generally I really groove on it in this. You know, I think people read this and we associate the woman in whose dress was the sun and had the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head, who's about to give birth, with Mary. But she's not called Mary, right? So I think she is associated with Mary, and she's associated with Mary later on, but Mary was also associated with the great lady of the temple. So I really do see her as a Sophianic figure. And you know, I can also see the sex worker, I'll stop being cute. I can also see the Whore of Babylon as in sort of a phonemic sense, where as almost a Cephian Sophia, because I am starting to agree with people. There's certain scholars when we read Secret John or read some of the Cephian texts, we kind of mash all the divine female figures together, right? And they can be aspects and reflections of each other. But there is a theory that the Cephians didn't think that highly of Sophia. And that kind of gets reflected later on. You know, what got me thinking about this was some of the Platonic Gnostics associated Sophia with the god of the witches, the goddess of the witches, right? The goddess of the crossroads, who was a character that the Greeks and Romans were uncomfortable with, right, and had mixed feelings about. So anyways, I'm on a rant. I better move on to, oh yeah, I also like that there is the voice of the thunder. Oh, go ahead, please.
Oh, can I ask a question, Deacon Angie? I maybe you said it and I missed it. Since you've read Barker, and I haven't ventured into the Barkerian waters yet, because I'm a little scared to do that. It seems very overwhelming. And fascinating, but it just seems like a lot. So you have, and I'm wondering, you were just speaking about the Great Lady. Is that what she's called in Barker? Is that right?
That's what Barker is calling her, yes.
Okay. So I assume that that's specifically the woman with the moon at her feet in Revelation.
Yeah, I mean, Barker talks about the Great Lady as I think spouse is the wrong word, but co-creator with God. So she's there at the beginning of Genesis. And she calls her, we have records of her being called Asherah, or
right, however, an Asherah figure.
However that's pronounced in a variety of different ways. And she sort of highlights there's several different pronunciations of the name, but it's very similar throughout multiple cultures. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so she's there at the beginning, and she's with people until she's essentially eradicated. How to compare the Great Lady to Babylon. And what I read of Margaret Barker is that she didn't get into that. Now, of course, she's got the 600-page book that she likely does get into it, because it doesn't seem a topic that Margaret would shy away from.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. I think that is the Babylon is the second temple, right? So a parody of the Great Lady. Mm.
But to your point about the Cephians and Sophia being conflicted, I definitely get that sense of the Sophia in the Cephian text is not somebody you actually want to be connecting with, in that she's really made a huge mess of things, and to stay away from her.
Yeah. Nick, were you going to say something?
I think it's actually coming up next, but Jonathan, your list is really good. But I was thinking that, and I think this is in Margaret Barker, I'm not an expert on Margaret Barker, but I think one of the understandings that she puts forward is that some of the temple theology survives into Christian liturgy,
yes.
Which to me is actually the main way to interpret this book, is as a liturgical book. I think, you know, even in the kind of Orthodox Christian interpretations of the kind of lady figure that has kind of made its way to some Marian theology and iconography, it's frequently talked about as the church. And then that kind of directly leads, again, to the end of the book with the New Jerusalem, which is also an image of this kind of glorified church. So I think, which is constituted through the liturgy. So I think there's a whole kind of liturgical aspect to the book, which doesn't actually contradict necessarily the Margaret Barker thesis, but is kind of the way that it becomes subsumed or kind of subterraneanly kind of remains within the tradition, but through the liturgical stuff in Christianity, which have taken some of the temple forms. So to me, that's actually like the best way to read the book is as a liturgical document. And so maybe we could talk about that.
Yeah, and that's what Barker says. She loves the liturgy, particularly Eastern forms of it. But she sees those coming straight from the temple. I mean, it's really hard to read this book without seeing the liturgy in it. It is obviously a liturgical text. It is portraying, you know, real rituals that people did. It is showing liturgy both in heaven and earth. But actually, talk about the liturgy both in heaven and earth brings us to the strongest, most obvious theme of the book, and why it can be reclaimed from evil political powers that have been abusing it for years, right? Which is that it's obviously an anti-empire book. It's talking about Rome. It more or less tells you what is the quote? Oh, geez, I had it here. But the seven hills, the seven heads.
Seven heads.
Yeah, Rome.
Yeah.
Rome. It actually says the seven heads are the seven hills. and Rome is the city of the seven hills. 666 or 616. You can use gematria to maybe I'll get I don't know Nick. Maybe you can explain gematria really quick. But you can use gematria to get Kaiser Nero, Caesar Nero. The Antichrist is obviously Nero. Nero had just recently died, right around the time that this book was written, and there was rumors and legends that Nero was going to come back to life as the beast does. Actually, there was Nero impersonators who had tried to say in sort of the outer regions of the empire with people who had never seen the emperor before, hey, I'm Nero, come back to life. You know, you should let me rule you. And of course, you know, the Christians are very oppressed. The book does talk about, you know, you are the poor and I'm going to comfort you. And I can't remember the name of the writer, Nick. It was the article.
Wes Daniels is Resisting Empire.
Yeah, Resisting Empire. Yeah. He talks a lot. They talk a lot about the liturgy of God and the liturgy of Earth, right? And that this book sets up. That's one of the reasons it uses the liturgy. Why it uses this liturgical symbolism, because it's saying, you know, like there is the liturgy of God, which we can go join in, right? We can go join the feast of God with the people of God, with the liturgy of God at any time, actually. And it can comfort us and it can strengthen us. It can bring us closer to God to get through these travails. But there's also the liturgy of the earth, which is the liturgy of the empire, the liturgy of Rome. And it is a liturgy of destruction. It is a ritual of humiliation. It is a ritual of the destruction of the poor and those that believe. So what do people think about some of the, oh, sorry, Nick, could you first explain gematria really quick? And maybe how, do you know how they get 666 out of that? And then maybe we can talk about some of the political.
I cannot tell you how they get 666 in this. Gematria obviously being like where, you know, in Hebrew letters and in Greek too, depending on, you know, what you're using, have numerical values, and that you can figure out like kind of the cumulative numerical value of words and phrases, and then through that figure out correspondence between them. So I don't know where that, for Aleister Crowley, believe that 666 was the number of humanity, or the number of a man, actually, is what he would have said. And then also connected to the sun. So that is, he had his own gematria for that. I don't know how the book gets to that, actually.
Yeah. I think it is pretty straightforward, though, because, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Hebrews all used letters to represent numbers, right? So that's why it's quite easy to do gematria. So people reading it would have got who 666 is pretty easily. But yeah, any other comments on sort of the play? Oh, go ahead, Jason.
I wanted to push there a bit. Do we know that gematria was happening around the time whenever this book was being written? Like, is that okay? Yeah, I just wasn't sure. I mean, I've always felt gematria is dodgy, so I was like, when did the dodginess begin, is basically my question.
Even Margaret Barker talks about it being contemporary, so, you know, if we're going by her as an expert, she also agreed with it.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. It apparently is related to Aramaic and Hebrew. So Nero Caesar in the Hebrew alphabet would actually add up to 666.
Yeah. And the books, most certainly, it might be one of the few New Testament books that was originally in Hebrew. They know that it was originally in Hebrew because it uses a lot of Hebrewisms, Hebrew or Aramaic. It uses, because they both have some of the same cliches, sentence structure, what have you. that it was quite possibly in that language, originally translated into Greek or written by somebody who's very saturated in that language and does not know Greek very well. Clark has just been caught up into the heavens. So he can't comment on the Greek, but it is apparently very poor and full of these Hebraicisms.
Can I speak to the liturgy and the empire bit a little bit?
Please.
Yeah. I think the important thing we didn't mention yet is that Russ Daniels in that book does mention this a lot, which is one of the recurring phrases in the book, and kind of arguably the protagonist is the slain lamb. So it's not just, you know, God the Father or Jesus. It's actually the lamb that looks like, it says the lamb that was slain, but it's the lamb that was standing up and looks like it was slain. So it's basically a dead lamb also with seven horns and seven eyes that is the hero of the book. Mm-hmm. And I think, and the way Wes reads this and other people, I think the reason this book has actually been used really frequently in kind of a radical political way in, you know, liberation theology and empire critical biblical studies and other kind of places is because the slain lamb and then the martyrs that are mentioned throughout the book are, you know, poor and dispossessed people that the empire has been oppressing. So the idea that this book was written in some relationship to, you know, after the Jewish and Roman war, the destruction of the temple, you know, all of that, there's a context of oppression of the Jesus movement that this book is being written out of. And so the oppression of, you know, a poor and marginalized group in the empire. And then the hero of the book is a slain figure, this, you know, oppressed and marginalized minority, basically. So I think it's important that this conversation about, it is true that the narrative is like an empire, one empire replacing another. So God's empire over the Roman Empire, but there is this element of it being like this kenotic empire. It's emptied, self-emptied. So it's an empire that is centered around, you know, the poor and marginalized as opposed to centered around kind of imperial glory or power if you're taking it in that historical context. And then I also think that then the death of God piece that does play out is that the liturgy itself in Christianity and that as it starts to develop in liturgical theology is participating in this, you know, oppression and crucifixion of Jesus. So you go to the liturgy, it's not like an abstract kind of ritual. It's actually you entering into this, the death of this person, the slain lamb. So it's the liturgy of the lamb when you go to mass. And then, you know, the resurrection or the new Jerusalem that emerges out of that. And when we get into that part of the book, I think it becomes clear is no longer a kind of hierarchical kingdom where it's like, we're here, God's up there vertically, but it's kind of becomes a flat, you know, a flat and imminent world where God dwells with us and kind of equally to everyone. So I think that there is a really beautiful narrative that the only way you can get to it though, is by remembering that the slain lamb, that oppressed people are actually at the core of the subject of the book. Otherwise it becomes this abstract, you know, sort of crazy, like a psychedelic thing.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure I was in there.
Oh, please. Okay. And I was just going to agree with you and say you're spot on. And again, to clarify about the liturgy and what's going on with the liturgy and connecting to the slain lamb is, you know, you are joining the death of Christ, which is joining his oppression. Right. Mm-hmm. We all take part in the oppression of empire. Right. And therefore have solidarity. When I say we all take, well, we all take, I mean, you know what I mean? I meant to clarify your point, Nick. And I just take.
No, I think that was good because we participate. I mean, the liturgy is not an abstract kind of reenactment, but it's a participation in the slain lamb. So from that, it changes it.
So quick question then. I missed half of this. Sorry. I'm not good with computers, so it almost killed me, or I almost killed it. I don't know which. So okay. So it sounds like you're saying what I caught was that when God's heaven, a kingdom comes down here, things go from vertical to horizontal, and that we have to get there by identifying with Jesus. But I did not get that in the book. What I got was that Jesus was an oppressor in the book. He walks around with an iron rod to keep all the Gentiles in line, and I thought long and hard about this iron rod thing, and I don't see it as anything other than a physical threat. It's I think it's clear violence. So I'm not really sure how we do that. So I probably missed that. I'm sure you have an explanation for it, but I was wondering what it was.
I mean, I think that so Jesus does seem pretty violent when he's mentioned as Jesus. That's the little separate figure from the lamb in the book. I do think that
they're not the same?
No, I think that the lamb is Jesus, but I think that that imagery, there's two sets of imagery going on. But I would also say that an oppressed people writing a book that includes violence, mostly reacting to the oppression they're facing, isn't quite the same thing as, you know, as imperial violence. So I wouldn't want to condemn the revolutionary
violence. Are two different things, for sure. Yeah. I agree with you on that. But I just didn't see the self-defensive violence in that. I mean, I have to reread it. I'm sure it's just in there. I just missed the indication that it was self-defense.
This is actually like Clark's question sort of also spurred on something that I was really reacting to, which was that like it's that thing of like it's not getting rid of the empire. It's just replacing it with another empire. Like which to me rankled. I was like, to me, the whole thing about like what I love about Gnosticism as I encounter it is its apophatic quality. It's engagement with something that's indescribable. And in that sense, very like there's a solidarity in the sense that we're all going to be part of or are part of one thing. And so I think like, yeah, like in a way, this feels, if not anti-Gnostic, at the very least, maybe for me, like it's revolutionary, maybe in that sense, the same way like the French Revolution was revolutionary, but there's also a sense of perpetuating a form because you don't have anything else to replace it with. You know, like you break up all the courts and then you have to form new courts, you know. But because this isn't a political document trying to describe a thing that people should do, like you know, like here's our to-do list. It's right. Like it's a science fiction or fantasy document proposing a metaphysical change. Like I'd love to see a Gnostic revelatory gospel that wasn't saying like, here's the new boss. He has to wear the same suit as the old boss, you know?
But I would still not. So I'm going to push back on both of those things a little bit, and which is that I don't think it's the same as the old boss because of the identification of the new boss as being this slain lamb who was slain in the context of this empire. So it's just not the lamb doesn't heal. Like the wound doesn't go away. That kind of marginalization and oppression kind of remains in the lamb's identification throughout the book and becomes kind of a central part of the people in the New Jerusalem's, you know, their own kind of citizenship in that capital city or something. I think there's a change. The other thing I would say about it is, you know, in terms of the oppression or the context of that, part of that is the historical context of the book that's been proposed by scholars. But I think it's in the book in the parts about the martyrs. So it can seem very violent, but there's multiple pieces where the blood of the martyrs cries out and says, how long do we have to wait for, you know, this reality to be reversed because we were martyred. And so in the context of it about, you know, the coded message about Nero, the persecution of the early Jesus movement, you know, it can only really be read historically in that context of people who are already being kind of crushed politically. So I think losing that, it stops to kind of work that well, and does then become the new boss and the old boss. But I think with that context, and I think that reality of the slain lamb, I think it does change it. And so like what Jonathan said, I think thinking about liturgy as participation in the death of Christ is very important. If you lose that piece, it can start to become a slightly more abstract, you know, I don't know, like divinity, but it stays centered if it remains with that kind of very human death of a person by this empire. So that's what I'd say about it. But it doesn't resolve the book of all the issues, but, you know.
No, for sure. And I think, too, there's a lot of parody in the book because, you know, the word for kingdom of heaven is the same word used for the Roman Empire, right? Really, we should be translating it empire of heaven. And the Roman emperors call themselves living gods, right? So that's why we have this antichrist, this fake god, a very Gnostic concept. It's always contrasting the kingdom of heaven, sorry, the empire of heaven with the empire of Rome, right? Or let's call it the Black Iron Empire. And this happens throughout the book over and over again. So for instance, Nero the Antichrist has a wound that doesn't heal in his head, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the slain lamb, but the slain lamb is the real deal. The other thing too about the imminence that Nick's talking about is looking at it as a Johannine text, having some sort of relationship to the other Johannine texts. There's the theory that the Johannines Johannites, whatever you want to call them, that that they didn't necessarily believe in the bodily resurrection as we know it, in the second coming. They didn't believe in the second coming. Or sometimes the resurrection. Maybe there's a version of the Gospel of John that doesn't have a resurrection at the end. Anyways, Jesus comes back in the hearts of the Johannites, right? Imminence. That's why this is, if you look through that lens, that's why this is not a replacement of the empire, right? Because there is no new ruler, because God has come to earth in the hearts of everybody. So there's radical equality.
And that's why he can, right? Yeah. God.
Oh, I was going to say that's why he can wipe our tears away, right? Because we are all wiping each other's tears away.
Yeah. And I think that part, so at the end where after the New Jerusalem comes down, I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is Lord God, the Almighty and the Lamb. It becomes, there's no need for any kind of cultic worship anymore that would have been present, you know, in the second temple or in the empire, because God is now with us in that way, and specifically God in the form of this slain lamb. So I think that to me is actually a death of God message. It's kind of the dead body of God or the dead body of the lamb that is now with us. And, you know, so to me, that's a kind of a radical imminence going on by the end of the book.
Yeah. But don't get me wrong, Clark, Jason, like, Bart Ehrman really doesn't like this book and really sees it as a violent, discriminatory book. And it is that as well. Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. As Nick said, it doesn't explain everything. It's just a different light to think about it. It's a new light. I have to reread it in that light with the details as I understood them.
Yeah, exactly. But there is tensions in the book, right? Like it is hard to have one reading of it because you know it is a book that has a lot of polarities, that has a lot of tensions and what have you. So something else that the book is often written up for that it's often seen as guilty of is misogyny, right? So I think probably the best person to speak about that would be Jason. I'm kidding, Deacon Angie. Do you have any takes on misogyny and the Book of Revelation?
I mean, honestly, like, it's so overwhelming that with the misogyny that it's hard to even say anything about it. Like, it just, I don't know. Honestly, it's sort of one of those things that it just, it's hard to even relate to it beyond, you know. I can kind of stand it when I'm thinking about Margaret Barker's, you know, guy back, you know, back to the great lady. But as far as all the other stuff, I mean, just imagery of you know, abusing women, it's just constant through the, you know, Old Testament and frankly, most of Christianity. And it just, there's not a whole lot to say about it.
Sorry, you did remind me by invoking St. Barker that there was to bring it back to some positive depictions of women, which is there's a mysterious little passage, which is after he called out, the seven thunders answered with a roar. As soon as they spoke, I was about to write, but I heard a voice speak from heaven. Keep secret what the seven thunders have said. Do not write it down. And of course, like that's pretty puzzling where this is a revelation. part two is the voice of the thunder, you know, the voice of the thunder is a Gnostic name for Sophia. So I think that might be another secret appearance of the Lady of the Temple. Hey, everybody wants to listen. We're actually already getting close to an hour, but everybody wants to hear me rant about things that I autistically fixate on, right? But the Clark, you might like this. So mainstream biblical, I believe this to be one of the earliest books of the New Testament, right? It's Paul's letters and this. Because to give some of the context that Nick was talking about, which I should have given at the top of the show, the book is probably from, you know, like 72 AD. Nero, who died in 69 AD, was oppressing and persecuting and martyring the Christians. Then Rome comes in, destroys the Second Temple. It's a horrific war on the Jews, on the Hebrews, on Israel, of everybody who belonged to those communities. We're talking war crimes that are almost inconceivable. And this is the context that the book is written in, all of this oppression, right? It's very hard to read it and not see it as an early text for a variety of different reasons. A lot of biblical scholars want to recreate an early Christianity that has a very volkish, folky Jesus, right? Who doesn't have very sophisticated ideas, who doesn't have anything to do with liturgy, who may think that the end of the world is coming soon, but he's very unsophisticated about it. And his theology is viewed through the lens of a later Judaism. Right, there has been very important work done understanding the Jewish Jesus, right? And mm-hmm. this was a big part of 20th century biblical studies. But I find that often we are viewing him through later developments in Judaism, through rabbinic Judaism. I also find it classist as well, because there's this idea that if you're a working class person like Jesus probably was, you can't have wild theology. You can't have wild ideas. But I mean, you know, like I know working class people who have all sorts of ideas about a religion. You know, there's lots of working class people who have written sci-fi and fantasy novels. So they can really get some pretty amazing stuff. So in this book, I find the importance of liturgy, very early liturgy. These people must have been doing liturgy. Where did it come from? If this book predates much of the Bible, possibly even Mark, I think it predates Mark. Here we have stuff, quotes from Jesus. There are quotes from Jesus throughout this book that we find in the Gospel of Mark and find in the Gospel of John. I think most scholars would say that you know, the writer of Revelation got it from those books, or got it from oral traditions, or got it from mm-hmm. Q, which doesn't exist. But I would say that these are probably genuine memories of what Jesus taught. And he might have, Margaret Barker really turned me on to this, Deacon Angie. You might appreciate it. You know, how many times have I read this book and I never noticed that the opening is, this book is the record of the events that Jesus Christ revealed. God gave him this revelation in order to show his servants what must happen very soon. Right? But mm-hmm. the book says at the very beginning that Jesus had these revelations. So this is sort of a build out from this writer of some of the things that Jesus told him. Now I'm hoping, you know, some of the extreme mm-hmm. violence and some of the misogyny, you know, obviously these are the teachings of Jesus tinged through this horrific lens that we talked about and through this own writer's gnosis, right? But I really think that this is an important picture of early Christianity that a lot of scholars reject, because they really want to have a very very Protestant folky Jesus, right? Without any of this Catholic stuff.
Yeah. I would say also with that, because of the liturgical context, you know, the way I would interpret it, and John of Patmos has this vision, he says specifically on the Lord's Day. So presumably he would have engaged in worship. And then, so one of the interpretations of this book is that it's kind of like a psychedelic internal description of what's happening when you're participating liturgically, which is seems a little esoteric, but you can read some I wouldn't recommend it necessarily, but you can read some Roman Catholic, pretty mainstream Catholic books about that this book is about the Mass, including like Scott Hahn's book, The Lamb's Supper, which is a pretty good book, has terrible puns in it. But you know, so, oh yeah, you might like it. But the way
I've got to say, that is not a selling a Catholic Mass for me.
Yeah, no, it depends. I guess what your kinks are. but I do think it kind of like, you know, when it's understood that way, hopefully without some of the imagery and the ways it's kind of, you know, woven together through whoever wrote its, you know, own experiences and biases, it portrays, you know, like we said, this participation in the death of Christ. That's how they would have understood what they were doing in liturgy, that, you know, this, like, so in some, you know, all of the really ragged and violent and seemingly kind of disgusting parts of it are related to that experience of the early Christian movement in what happened to, you know, this person that they revered. So I think that there is something to be said about it in that way, that it's a participation in the liturgy without kind of whitewashing the liturgy from ultimately being a representation of this horrific death of this person in torture. So, which a lot of time does get whitewashed out. So I think that it doesn't recommend you the Catholic Mass, but it might be true.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you brought some of that up because of the inner interpretations. Oh, sorry. Were you going to say something, Clark?
Oh, no, this is all new ideas to me, and so I'm just taking it in. This is very interesting. I noticed, of course, the details about the religious activities going on, but that's...
Yeah. I think outside of the liturgy or inner liturgy, yeah. I mean, he basically does tell us, Nick, that this happened to be during liturgy, right? So inner depiction of liturgy, but mystics since have viewed it as an inner text, right? So I can see, like, everything is creative, not everything, but the creative reinterpretation of symbol sets is how religion, quote unquote, works. And the imagery in this book is so powerful that I think for inner imaginative work, it could be quite powerful. So for instance, Gnostic Ascent, right? There's people trying to recreate Gnostic Ascent. We don't know exactly what they did, but here we have seven seals, seven angels. In many Gnostic Ascent systems, there's the seven archons and the seven planets, right? So maybe somebody could use this to construct a ritual or guided meditation where they're doing Gnostic Ascent, and this is what you have to overcome through each archon, right? Something else that people have been doing for the last couple hundred years is saying that this is the Kundalini experience. This comes from the Theosophists, that each of the seven seals is the seven chakras. And this is what is happening in your enlightenment experience, because, you know, enlightenment can often be very difficult and hard. And of course, as Nick said, maybe it's an inner depiction of what's happening during the liturgy. But you folks have any reflections on sort of inner meanings of the text, or perhaps reappropriating it to use some of its symbolism for, you know, path working?
I mean, if it's inner, I can see a lot of PTSD stuff going on in it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think that might be, there too, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. How could you go through the destruction of Jerusalem? How could you go through Nero's persecutions and not have PTSD?
Yeah exactly.
Here's kind of what I'm grappling with like this whole time is that I think like there's some really interesting stuff. Nick, I want to point out actually that your point about if this is a revolutionary text from an oppressed group, like there's sort of that thing where like it's not fair to demand that a group that's been oppressed be enlightened enough to both combat that oppression and somehow have this benevolent vision. Like that might be too much to ask. I'm not totally sure I buy. I say it's a speculative text, so part of me wants it to go there anyway. But that said, part of what I really grapple with is that like I think yes, I can see like actually the idea of as an ascent, like if Revelation were essentially my imaginative writings as I fought myself as I was trying to meditate. You know, like just learning to meditate, like I, Jason, decided I was going to meditate every day of the year, and this is what happened to my brain. You know, the revelations of Jason. I mean, I'm joking, but I think like that idea of the struggle as depicted so imaginatively, I think that's totally possible. But where I'm going here is that I'm having also a really hard time divorcing this from the Bible as a corpus of text that has been used a certain way throughout history. Yeah. And that it's totally possible to read all of this stuff this way and to like reinterpret it. But like, I'm just kind of angry that it's in the Bible it's in the Bible. It's at the end of the Bible. It doesn't say, oh, and by the way, he's totally talking to these churches that are like within his lifetime. And he's totally referring, like there's a political cartoon element. Like it does, because the Bible that I'm holding right now doesn't prepare me for that, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
that's kind of why I started off my like hot take with like, it's just a shame that it's in the Bible, because this book, like it says Holy Bible, it sounds like I should read everything in here straight-faced, you know?
That is why people have wanted to take it out, including Martin Luther, so yeah.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And like, and so there's sort of the, like, and maybe leaning into the struggle is just something I've got to do. And I'm kind of freestyling here, guys, but like, there's a thought I keep having, like, is there value in reclaiming something that has had such bad stuff associated with it? You know, like a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of been talking about this in personal conversations quite a bit. So there's like a pre-empire religion and a post-empire religion, right? And now this book was written pre-empire, so it's going to be in a completely different context. But once I have yet to come across an And if there is an example, I would love to see it. But an example of religion that went from pre-empire to actual administrative, you know, civil body, I haven't seen that transition ever happen gracefully. Like, it doesn't matter what religion it is. Once it goes from being something people practice to something that administers how people need to live in a societal way, it completely distorts it. And I think we really run up to this with the Book of Revelations, because again, it was written in a time where essentially the priests in Christianity were not the actual judges of civil cases, you know, arguing over land, right? Like that context, and those two contexts are so drastically different that I think, yeah, we're reading it after, you know, 1500 years of empire religion, and we're trying to divorce ourselves from that in some regard. But it's so intertwined and so messy, and so many of our foundations are built on it, that it's a hot mess. So that's my take on that.
I would say that in terms of if it doesn't make sense to reclaim it. I mean, I think unfortunately the type of reality it's describing and maybe the trauma that it comes out of is just in our world, and we can't, it's not something that we're going to get away from. So I feel like almost getting rid of it though is, you know, people are going to write from those experiences again, having to deal with it or go through it to the other side, which is kind of what happens in the text. You go through all this horrific shit, and then you get to the side of every tear wiped away. I mean, I think that process is what history is like and what our experience in the world is like. So I would be hesitant to just get rid of it, I guess.
Yeah. You know, what I would say is it's something we need to appropriate more from Jewish traditions, culturally appropriate, is really interrogating and arguing with the text. Because, for instance, a Jewish interpretation of the sacrifice of Abraham by his son, the attempted sacrifice, right, is that Abraham failed. And God came in at the last moment to save his son because he was like, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. Like, you just screwed up, buddy. Like, I gave this to you as a test. To win the test, you had to not go sacrifice your son to me. Yeah. What's the matter of your brain? So I think sometimes having that approach can help us. But I think it is important to argue with these texts and to keep them, because they're in the collective unconscious of the West, right? They're not going away. There's Christians out there using them all the time. If we want to get rid of them, they're still going to be used, right? We also have 2000, again, even like art, right? We have 2000 years of great art coming out of this book. How are we going to engage with that art, understand that art, critique that art without dealing with the book? Finally, for keeping it in the Bible. Oh, go ahead.
I want to say here, I'm trying to say we should take it out of the Bible, because, I mean, that ship has sailed thousands of years, like at least 1,000 some years ago. The ship is so sailed. The ship's come back around again. But I think, like, my point there about how it's not, like, there's nothing at the beginning of the book, like, you know, it feels to me that there almost would need to be like a, for you to start reading it, like every few pages, there has to be just a little like asterisk. And then at the bottom, it says like, note, here's some historical context for this. Yeah. Note, this is where this is coming from. Yeah. Like, because
I've
that's kind of
Bibles that do that. And I completely agree with you, Jason. Yeah. It's, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah,
I have
my,
seen
my
it
official the Catholic Bible does do that too. Yeah. Not that that's like,
okay. Not all of them do. And they really should. Yeah. Sorry.
Like, yeah. That's the thing. This one didn't. And I bought it at a bookstore, you know, and I think that that's kind of more the thing I keep talking about, is that like, there's so many lines that I'm like, oh, that's where that line comes from that I've heard people leverage for terrible things, you know?
Bad things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of bad things. Clark, but before we move on, as a non-Christian Clark, do you have any opinion on this at all? Or do you just not care?
Oh, about the book?
Yeah.
I mean,
Bible and whatever.
I mean, I have opinions on all that, more opinions, just on this book, I think if you're going to reclaim this book, if that's a good way to put it, it's a lot of hard work to be done. I really appreciate the notion of trying to make this a more positive take on empire, and I really have to sit down and rethink about that. because my opinion of the revelation is very bad. It's very negative. I see a lot of I just see a lot of assholes beating each other up, including everybody in between the two assholes, and then justifying it later, you know, like a street fight. And it's hard to see. So that's kind of my take on it. It's hard to see how this is redeemable, unless, of course, you're a Jesus person. And then Jesus then that rewrites the whole story. Admittedly, it obviously does, and makes it into a better story. But when I read this book, the whole time I was reading this book, I just kept thinking, Russian Revolution in 1918, Revolution in 1918, over and over again. All of the people are killing each other for 100 different reasons, and then it didn't stop. And then some good things came out of that, great things came out of that, and then some horrible things came out of that. And now here we are in the Ukraine again for the same reasons. It didn't stop. It just cycled back around. Yeah. So I don't really know what this text, the effect this text has on stopping the cycle of political violence in the world, which is a Gnostic I'm very concerned with.
I would I know I'm being the defender.
Unless, of course, you put Jesus in it, yeah. What was that, Nick?
Yeah, I know I'm being the defender of the text, and like I
said, you should be.
It's a little hard for me. Like, I'm stumbling through it a little bit because, like I said at the beginning, this is a really sacred text to me because of, like you said, Clark, the Jesus thing. I do identify as a Christian still, so I think, you know, I put it in the link in the chat. But Wes's book that Jonathan's talked about, Resisting Empire, just to give some context, he's a Quaker theologian. And Quakers who have a history of nonviolent resistance have actually read this text as part of their nonviolence, which seems very contradictory at first. But I think, like you're saying, Clark, reading it through that lens of Jesus really changes it. And one of the things, I think it's probably in Wes's book, but I think it's also in other people, like I know Rene Girard's writings about scapegoats, which Wes is building on as well, is that, and I think the Russian Revolution comparison is really apt because part of the argument from Wes is that this book is anti-scapegoating because the lamb that has been slain is the end of that process. So it never happens again. Yeah. It's represented in the liturgy because now that it has shown the bankruptcy of you know, building a human empire on the basis of that kind of scapegoating and political violence, because this has happened in this cosmic way. So I do think that it's not a text like a blueprint for doing a Russian revolution. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to read this and we're going to carry this out as a revolution. It's about something internal, which then I think is why the cosmic and liturgical and mystical readings are important, because it can't just be the literal. It has to be, I mean, I read the ending as a little Buddhist almost, like this is something that's happening now and not something that's in the future. It's already happened. Right. So, yeah.
And I'd like to say it'd be a pretty boring panel if we all had the same perspectives. Okay, we're at an hour and 15 minutes. Start to wrap up very quickly. Something else I like about the book, or it being in the Bible, is, again, there's been so much work done about how different books of the Bible come from different communities, have different perspectives, have different Christologies, have different ideas about God, don't necessarily agree with each other, and it's very important to understand this, right? This is one of this is kind of Biblical Studies 101, right, if you're going to take secular biblical studies. But what we miss is that the editors of the Bible were very sophisticated. So There's a couple of reasons why this book ends the Bible. I mean, one is very literal, right? It's the end of the story. But another reason too is that it uses a lot of Genesis symbolism, you know, 7 days, seven seals, the tree of life, the tree is restored to earth, right? And people can go eat the fruit whenever they want. And something else that I find very interesting about the ending and how it can be the story of humanity is how does Genesis open? Where's humanity? We're in a garden. How does Revelation end? We're in a city, right? So this is the story. Mm. This is the story of humanity. Okay. Any more hot takes before we sign off?
I would say that sometimes we've said it as Revelations.
I know.
And I have a joke about that, which my wife heard at church camp when she was a kid, which is from a pastor, which is it's Revelation, not Revelations. The S is for Satan. So every time you say it that way, you're letting Satan in. That probably doesn't.
I am a great spiritual multiplier.
Yeah, I'm picturing Mar Thomas just grinding his teeth every time we said Revelation.
Oh yeah, right.
I said it as well, yeah.
As he breaks out in the meat sweats.
Okay, excellent place to end. Oh wait, nope, not.
I do.
Go, Jason.
Yeah, there's also one thing I need to mention. Probably before I read through the book of Revelation for this podcast, my closest connection to Revelation was somebody who did a webcomic in like the early aughts that was Pokemon inspired. So it's like manga Pokemon inspired. It's still online. You could basically Google Pokemon webcomic Revelation, or it's called a Pokemon. And yeah, I would suggest just go take a look. It's wacky. It's weird. It's like, it's tongue in cheek. So it's going back to Clark, to your idea of it being a graphic novel. This is someone going like, this would be cool to draw. I'm not taking it seriously, yeah, but it's going to be cool to draw. Since Gnosticism has a tendency towards heresy, I thought I'd reference a heretical webcomic.
Yeah. I'll link it in the show notes. So, okay. Any other hot takes?
I lost track of how many times a third of the stars got knocked out of the sky. I think it was 4.
It is. I do really like this book, but it is a little repetitive, to say the least. Okay, well, I had the perfect ending for the end of the world show, which is, I heard a loud voice speaking from the throne. Now God's home is with human beings. He will live with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them, and he will be their God. He will wipe away all tears from their eyes. There will be no more death, no more grief or crying or pain. The old things have disappeared. And the one who sits on the throne said, and now I make all things new.